One more time. Can you say it one more time? All right. It's so awesome. You got to wonder, like, where'd she learn to say we did it? Like, was it a cartoon? Was it? So I'm super stoked to share with you guys today. Like, really. Like, there are these moments where I feel like I'm making things up now. No, there are those. I won't tell you one, I promise. You'd rather just not know. But there are these moments where I feel like, you know, God's just been speaking to my own heart, and out of the wellspring of just sort of the things that I feel I've learned, I'm like, wow, this is so appropriate to our community. I've learned over the course of time that not everything that goes through my head I should talk about, and also not everything that's for me should be shared. And so I'm hoping that today I've appropriately selected the thing that should be said and not said. So if any of you guys saw my post a few weeks ago about Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath, I don't know, some of you guys might see me on Facebook, I don't know. I've mentioned some of his work in the past and how I love the way this dude thinks and I love the way he writes. And so a lot of what I share today, if you guys have ever read his book, David and Goliath, might sound a little bit familiar. And the rest of it is just straight plagiarism. But Laura said it's not plagiarism because I'm not copying his work into writing. I'm just quoting everything he says and selling it as mine. So I don't think I can sue. Can I get sued for that? Is that? I can. Awesome. Not if I start of quote now, end of quote at the end. I am covered. No, but seriously. Today we're going to start with the story of David and Goliath. All right. We did it. We did it, right? And I want to, is there an echo? Is this loud? Yeah, can you lower that a little bit? Awesome. Thank you. Today we're going to start with the story of David and Goliath that is found in 1 Samuel 16. I won't read it because it's a very large segment, but for the most part, do we remember the story a little bit? A little bit? Some of us, maybe not. The quick recap of the story of David and Goliath. The battle of David versus Goliath is found in 1 Samuel 16, and the location of the fight was in this valley called Elah. And the Valley of Elah is actually a place that has historically has a lot of very unique conflicts that have occurred. The Saladins fought the Knights during one of the first Crusades in the 12th century, right in that very same valley, as well as Elah was a central location during the Maccabean Wars against the Syrians about 1,000 years before the Saladin and his army fought the Crusaders. And so it's an interesting place of a lot of contention. And when 1 Samuel 16 starts, you have the Philistines that are predominantly a seafaring people that are fighting further inland in an attempt to divide Saul's kingdom into north and south, with Elah being perfectly strategically located in that region, in Bethlehem, in that region to kind of cut off sort of supply lines. And so that's where in this valley, you have on one side the Philistines, and then on the other side, you have the Israelites. And that's something that's worth looking at, because when you think of what a conflict in a valley looks like, unless everyone's meeting in the middle, who's ever having to cross is at a severe disadvantage, because you're coming down and you're literally fighting an uphill battle to the other side. So both armies have sort of just like reserved to stay on either side and shout at each other before this idea of having two champions go back, you know, to fight each other kind of came in. And of course, in the story of David and Goliath, you have David who's showing up to bring supplies to his brothers, and he overhears, you know, Goliath commenting and making comments about the people of Israel. And so David, at which point, kind of inquires, what's going on? Why aren't you guys fighting? You know, what's happening? What are the rewards of taking this dude out? And then later on, speaking with King Saul, to try and ask for permission to represent Israel in this one-on-one fight. And of course, when he gets to King Saul's tent, Saul says to him, hey, you're just a kid, why don't you wear my armor and go in there and fight the guy, right? And so David's response is, that's dumb as hell. No. David's response is, I don't fit in your armor, I'll just fight the way I'm comfortable fighting. And so, as they say, the rest of the story is history. He fights Goliath. He prevails. But I think the reason I want to start with the story of David and Goliath is because I think what is introduced by Malcolm Gladwell is something that I find so unique that I've often, like in reading the story, always groped to figure out, but he verbalized it so well. He defines it as the most misunderstood story in the Bible. He's like, if there's a story I would say that is vastly misunderstood, it's this conflict between David and Goliath. And what's interesting is that it's taken on so much meaning in our culture, in our time, right? That's a phrase. It's a David and Goliath story, right? How many times do you hear about, you know, I remember in boxing tournaments, that was like the thing, right? The upcoming fighter versus the champion, a David and Goliath story. You know, it's just this term that we use to illustrate the idea of someone who's in a position of severe disadvantage facing something that's an impossible odd. And I guess my hope tonight is to challenge sort of our idea of what God is communicating in the story of David and Goliath in hopes to have us sort of relook at our approach to conflicts in our own lives. So my two main ideas I want to really strike, and I wanted to put this at the forefront because I realize how ambiguous so many of my statements can be. The first idea is most of what we consider valuable in our world arises from these kind of lopsided conflicts, a David and Goliath situation, because facing overwhelming odds, we understand, produces greatness, right? We can philosophically agree to that, I'm sure, when we're actually facing a giant in our own lives, proverbially speaking, of course. Suddenly it doesn't feel like it will produce greatness. It suddenly feels like it's just there to destroy us, demoralize us, bad things always happen to us, it rains all the time, you know, bad things happen in threes, all the negative sort of things we say when something bad happens. And the second idea that I want to sort of introduce is how consistently we get these kind of conflicts wrong. Something's out to get us, we just have all the worst luck in the world. We misread them, we misinterpret them, and the same quality that seems to give whatever our obstacle strengths actually reveals its actual weakness. The fact is that being an underdog changes people in ways that we often fail to appreciate. It opens doors, opportunities, educates, enlightens, and makes possible of what would often seem impossible. And that in our culture, we need, in my opinion, a better way of facing our giants, right? Because we often, again, misinterpret them. So, introduction. My hope is to marry both sociological and historical stories, some that are historical in nature in that we can sort of objectively look at something, some that it's more of accounts of sort of different successful businessmen and women who have sort of faced their own giants and draw some of those things and really begin to discuss and talk about what that looks like for our church. So if at any point, and we're going to try and manage this as best as possible, if you guys have questions, raise your hand. Once we exceed the limit of one question, no more questions. No? We will try, and I would like to answer questions because I realize sometimes I don't always do a great job illustrating well what I mean to communicate. So, story of David and Goliath. Let's look at it. Goliath enters this valley, and he antagonizes the Israelites, and he sees David. And his response to David is, are you kidding? Right? His response to David is, where's his armor? Where's his shield? What's this kid doing? Like, are you guys making fun of me? Is this supposed to be a joke, right? He does that because for Goliath, he goes into the conflict expecting to fight another warrior like himself. So what does Goliath look like? The Bible describes his equipment, and it says that he's carrying a heavy helmet and heavy armor, layered scales that would be similar in that time, like bronze. So he's wearing all this heavy armor and this heavy shield. He has a thrusting javelin that would often be made out of bronze during that time, and it was utilized to penetrate armor and shield sometimes. So he's got this javelin that he would use to thrust, and then he's got this weighted short-range spear, and the reason it's weighted is because if someone with enough strength can chuck it within a certain range, you can literally pick someone off the ground. So based on his description, we're seeing Goliath dressed as a heavy infantry fighter, right? If you guys saw the movie 300, The Spartans, the majority of their army are made up of Greek hoplites. They were considered the heavy infantry fighters during that Greek period. They carried a huge shield, they wore bracers, they wore a bronze breastplate, and they had a heavy spear that they would use in creating a shield wall, and as you've seen in the movie, do all the stuff that they did. And so Goliath is dressed in this like ridiculous like armor, right? And he shows up and he's expecting another warrior to face him blow for blow, hit for hit. He's expecting this sort of like, you know, battle of strengths and battle of you know, who can take a bigger hit than the other person. He's not expecting the actual conflict that arises. David, on the other hand, isn't dressed as an infantry fighter at all. And what's interesting is that to the untrained eye, you would look at David's situation and it would be easy to go, wow, this kid has a bunch of faith and he's looking, not to take that away from David, but you're going, wow, what's this kid doing? He's showing up with a rock and a sling and he's trying to antagonize this fight that between him and Goliath, and he's leaning on the sheer ability of God to show up to take out Goliath. And the part of the reason why our perspective is read that way is because we have very little understanding of military conflict at that time. Most battalions and most small armies consisted of people that fell in one of three groups. Group A was the heavy cavalry. These were the guys that were riding on horses that, you know, had spears that would run people down. Group B were your heavy infantry, right? These are your guys carrying your shields like Goliath. And group three were your missile fighters, or what we today would call artillery, right? These are your range fighters. These are your guys who use bows, and they use rocks, and they were slingers. It was a common sort of group. As a matter of fact, I think it was during the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians were climbing across a mountain range to get to conquer a local Greek city-state, and they were ambushed by a bunch of farmers with rocks and slings that murdered them. Why? You see, back then, the idea of people on horses versus people on wearing heavy armor versus people with slings was kind of like our modern-day rock, paper, scissor, right? Rock beats scissor, scissor beats paper, paper covers rock. Someone riding a horse could run down a slinger. A slinger could take out someone wearing heavy infantry. Someone wearing heavy infantry could knock someone off a horse. And so David showing up wasn't a foolish response. It's him going, I'm not going to fight you blow for blow because that's dumb. I have range and I'm pretty good. Like, why would I go hit you punch for punch? That's what you want me to do. But I'm not going to do that. That's not where I'm designed. That's not what I'm good at. That's why when during a lot of the trash talking between David and Goliath, David says to him, I took out the lion and the bear, you know, and just like them, I will take you out. He wasn't saying, I went toe-to-toe with a bear and knocked him out on the fourth round. No. He says, I maintained a safe distance and knocked those dudes out and chopped their heads off. And he was communicating the same thing. Goliath suddenly begins to realize, in my opinion, as you read that story, what starts off as like simple scorn turns into, why is he pulling out a rock? Oh, God. Like, to later on, sheer terror. Because he realizes he's been outsmarted and outwitted. And to the Israelites and the Philistines standing there, they wouldn't have looked at that situation and gone, oh, here's another kid. The second that rock came out, they're like, oh, no. Like, we didn't think about that. See, both Saul and Goliath had assumed that power only lies in raw strength. Never anticipating that someone would match strength with maneuverability and speed, right? We begin to recognize that sometimes conventional wisdom of our modern time says, this is what strength and power looks like. And then you get someone that comes around and redefines that and says, no, it can look differently, right? You see all those Bruce Lee videos, or, you know, I remember Enter the Dragon, where Bruce Lee takes on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's this big dude, and then, you know, you see this tiny guy with speed and maneuverability take him out. So David shows up, and he picks up five smooth stones, he places in his back, and he walks off to face Goliath, and he fires at Goliath at his most exposed point, because, and just to kind of look a little bit at what a sling looks like, just to kind of illustrate a little bit for you guys. A sling is made up of a pouch in the center with two ropes on the side, and the idea was that you would spin it over your head, and the more you spin it, you increase both the width of your circles and the speed that you're spinning it. You can literally spin a rock in a pouch at 6 to 7 revolutions per second. At 35 meters, it has the same stopping power as a modern-day handgun. Maybe not necessarily in terms of course, killing rate, right? A bullet embeds into your skull a lot easier than a rock does. But certainly, like, one of the historically, I think it was the, here, let me just read it to you guys, right? Etan Hirsch, he's a ballistic expert at the Israeli Defense Forces, and he recently did a series of calculations showing that a typical stone hurled by an expert slinger at a distance of 35 meters would have hit Goliath's head at 34 meters per second, more than enough to either penetrate his skull or cause severe injury. In terms of stopping power, it's equivalent to a modern-day handgun. David shot Goliath with a 45. Because Goliath was bringing a knife to a gunfight. And David looking at the situation goes, this is silly. David could literally hit Goliath at a distance of 35 meters in a second. Meaning at the speed that David was moving, Goliath would have been practically stationary by the time David released the shot. Meaning by the time it registered that he let go, he would have already been hit within that distance. There were actually, and just to kind of illustrate, you know, just a funny story. So I remember when I was a kid, just to even look at that example, I mean, really, you're putting a rock and you're throwing it at someone's head. And with the sling, I think the record for the fastest rock slung was 92 miles per hour. Could you imagine a pitcher pitching 92 miles an hour at your face with a rock? I mean, really. I remember when I was 12 years old, I was playing catch with my cousin, and he was talking trash, and he was bigger than me. Of course, he talked trash back, because what are you going to do? You got to defend your own honor. And he's like, you can't catch my pitches. I'm like, you, yes, I can. I was a vulgar kid. And so he tosses the ball as hard as he can. I remember three things. I thought I caught it. I remember it was in the glove. The three things I remember is looking up in a ball in the air, the sidewalk, and when I came to, I was already sitting up holding my head. And I remember just sitting there like couldn't believe what happened. He thought I had faked the whole thing. And he's like, it didn't look like it hit you. And I remember literally blacking out, complete blacking out, waking up, bleeding from my head, right? Few years before that, I remember another baseball. This is why I don't play baseball anymore. Another baseball incident. My stepdad used to play at a local league in New York, and we used to go and see his games. It was super boring. And I remember a bunch of kids got together, and they wanted to play, and another kid was talking trash. And as per usual, I responded, right? You know, I go, you can't hit a ball if whatever, right? And so me and this kid are trash talking, going back and forth, and I'm back in. Sitting there ready to catch the next pitch. Well, the kid takes two steps back right before he swings and hits me in the back of the head. Boom, blacked out. We're talking about a kid that was probably 8 years old. Knocks me out. I remember waking up and my sister is crying, getting my stepdad to come and address the situation. You know, in third grade, this one was not a baseball incident. Third grade, I was running during playtime, right, as kids do. And we're running, and I didn't realize I collided with someone. It wasn't until I woke up and blood was pouring down my head that I realized something even happened. So I'm running. I remember something happening. It happened so fast. I just remember just getting up off the ground and kind of like, what the heck just happened? I see another kid, and neither of us knew that we were just running, happened to be going in the same direction. I imagine God in heaven going, no! Veer left, just get out of the way, and we collide, and his front two teeth hit me in the back of the head. Happened so fast, I wasn't bleeding yet. Teacher walks over, says, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine. I'm like, what the heck happened? I see the kid get up, and he's holding his mouth, and I'm like, are you okay? I'm thinking maybe I headbutted him. He's like, I'm gonna feel fine. And all of a sudden, drip, 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 drip. And my New York Giants jersey gets ruined with blood coming down. The first stitches, that was the first set of stitches I got in my head. So we're just talking about kids playing around, not a professional soldier or someone who has had much experience with killing animals with rocks. The sling and the rock takes on a new meaning. Suddenly you don't view David as being in a disadvantaged position. Suddenly you start feeling bad for Goliath. And you start looking at a guy like David like, way to go. Well done. Well done. I think the story of David and Goliath often illustrates, at least to me, the challenge of re-looking at the way we resolve conflicts in our lives. Are we going the same hit for hit, punch for punch, response per response? Or are we using more wisdom in our approaches? David had mentioned twice Goliath's weapons as if to point out the wrong intention that the warrior Goliath had. At the point when David loaded his sling, there was little doubt who would win. David was a slinger, and slingers beat infantry hands down. Why do we not understand this? Why do we not understand that this is what the story is illustrating? It's because we misunderstand power. In our time, we seem to make the same mistake both Saul and Goliath make. They think of power in terms of physical might. They don't appreciate that power can come in many forms. Like I mentioned before, speed and maneuverability. This has major implications in the way we handle education, all the way to the way we fight crime. Our responses most often shows very little wisdom in our approach and just goes, it's just our raw responses of how we react to things. And so tonight I want to look at how City of Refuge stands in our responses to conflicts. And not just conflicts as defined as in, you know, localized conflicts or global conflicts, but simply to say, in the way we face our giants, how do we look at those things? Do we often look at them as impossible odds, like how are we gonna overcome this? Or is our response going, this is gonna be really cool, let's be creative and reconsider how we're gonna approach the situation? There was a Indian immigrant named, I'm going to mispronounce his name so terribly. Thank God, anyone here from India? Didn't think so. All right, awesome. So hopefully no one online gets offended at how I pronounce his name. Vivek Randiv decided to coach his daughter Anja's basketball team. He had settled on two principles when he decided to coach his basketball team. This, to me, is an amazing example of someone who uses innovation and wisdom in his approach to his giants. The first was that he would never raise his voice. Girls basketball team? This was national junior basketball, the Little League of basketball. The team was made up of mostly 12-year-old girls, and 12-year-old girls, in the experience that he knew, did not respond well to shouting and screaming and yelling. He would conduct business on the basketball court, he decided, the same way he conducted business at his software firm. He would speak calmly and softly, and he would persuade the girls of the wisdom of his approach and appeal to reason and common sense. That's a good start. The second principle was most important. Randiv was puzzled by the way Americans played basketball. He was from Mumbai, and he grew up with cricket and soccer. He would never forget the first time he saw a basketball game and how mindless he thought the sport was. Team A would score and then immediately retreat to its own end of the court. Then Team B would pass the ball in from the sidelines and dribble into Team A's end. Team A was patiently waiting for the opposition. Then the process would reverse itself. A regulation in basketball court is that all courts were 94 feet long. Most of the time, a team would defend only about 24 feet of that, conceding the other 70 feet. Occasionally, teams played a full court press, but that is, they contested their opponent's attempt to advance a basketball up the court. But they did it only for a few minutes at a time. It was as if there was some kind of conspiracy in basketball that had sort of set in, that widened the gap between good teams and only weakened teams that weren't that great. Right? You were allowed to use the full court, but it wasn't expected that you did. It was the polite thing to pull back and let the other team get the ball and get into position and run plays. But he found that to be stupid. He said, why? Why are you playing a game where the whole point is to gain the court advantage, but then you retreat and give it back to them? Did they fight for it? Do they own rights to that half of the court? Like, why wouldn't you press the attack and continue pushing forward? So the story continues and it says, good teams, after all, had players who were tall and who could dribble and shoot well. They could crisply execute their carefully prepared plays in their opponent's end. Why then did weak teams play in a way that made it easy for good teams to do the very things that they were good at? I remember playing basketball, and every time a play was drafted, it was always on the opponent's end. And that was just the way basketball was always introduced. Never did we use the side that we had gained in the previous play. It was like, no, you retreat back, catch your breath, prepare for the next attack. Although Randolph's team was smaller and had very little talent, these were the daughters of nerds and programmers. Randolph knew that if he played the conventional way, if they let their opponents dribble the ball up the court without opposition, they would almost certainly lose to the girls whom basketball was a passion. Randolph had come to America as a 17-year-old with $50 in his pocket. He was not one to accept losing easily, and his second principle then was that his team would play a full-court press every game, all the time. The team ended up at the national champions. It was random, his daughter Angie Randolph one time was quoted saying, I mean, my father had never played basketball before, and here he is coaching a team, and we're winning. Because he said, no, we're pressing the attack, and we're going to rattle the opponent. We're not going to play the way they expect us to play. We're going to play within the boundaries of what the rules allow, but we're going to play in an unconventional way. To better illustrate that, suppose you were to total up all the wars over the past 200 years that occurred between a very large and a very small country. Let's say that one side has to be at least 10 times larger in population and armed much bigger than the other. How often do you think the bigger side wins? So if you had two armies, one 10 times larger than another one, and better armed, how often do you think that country or army would win? How often? Give me a number. Percentage. 85% of the time, a larger army beats a smaller one. Do we have any betting people in here? This is church. Yeah. Yeah. Is it? Where's the money? Let's bet. Give me a number. How often do you think a larger army beats a smaller army? What was that? What'd you say? I can't even hear you from back here. I heard 70% over here, 80%? 70? It says, the actual answer may surprise you. When the political scientist Ivan Aragon Toft, which is an amazing political scientist, I think he was of German descent, did the calculations a few years ago. What he came up with, 71%. 71% a bigger army always beat a smaller army. That means that's close to a third of the smaller groups actually succeeded. And that's just historically looking at the fact that the smaller guy makes it out, not even looking at the success rates of bigger groups, right? So it says, it continues and it says, Aragon Toff asked the question slightly differently the second time. What happens in wars between a stronger and weaker when the weak side, like David, does not refuse to fight the way the bigger side wants to fight, using unconventional or sometimes guerrilla tactics? The answer in those cases was that the weaker party winning percentage climbs from 28.5% to 63% of the time. More than half the time, when a smaller opponent decides that he's going to fight in an unconventional way, historically, he wins. The United States faced the English. And when the English were lining up, the US citizen were like, no, I'm going behind that rock. Like, and we began to gain an advantage. A few people know that George Washington, after the U.S. really started gaining traction, actually started trying to fight the British blow for blow and lining up soldiers again. He said, hey, now that we're done doing that small stuff, we're an established army. We're going to fight punch for punch. And the U.S. started losing again. And he goes, yeah, let's get back behind the tree. Because they realize it's silly. What are we doing? Why are we fighting the way our enemy expects us to fight? Why aren't we reconsidering that we can use something different? To put that percentage in perspective, if the United States population is 10 times the size of Canada, if the two countries went to war and Canada chose to fight it unconventionally, history would suggest that you ought to put your money on Canada. We think of underdog victories as improbable events, and that's why the story of David and Goliath resonates so strongly with us in our culture. But historically, we see that underdogs win all the time. They win all the time. Why then are we so shocked every time we see a David beat Goliath? Why do we automatically assume that someone who has smaller or poorer or less skilled is necessarily at a disadvantage? It's like we somehow have fooled all of ourselves to believe that if we are an underdog, then there's no way that we have the ability to exceed our situation. And if we're at a position of being disadvantaged, I can't read well, I'm not good at math, then there's no way we're going to make it. Toff's study proves the exact opposite. He says, because you're in a disadvantaged position, or because you're having to recognize your weakness, that's where the seeds of innovation begin to spread out. You begin to rethink your challenge. You begin to rethink your opponent. You begin to take stock of your circumstance and say, I somehow have to figure this out, even if it means doing something I otherwise may not necessarily do. What was Vivek Rendenhoff's result with his basketball team? Well, he took his girls, he started making them play full court press. Every time that they practiced, they were not allowed anything more than a 7-second rest. All instructions had to be given in 7 seconds. The girls were constantly in motion. So every time these girls played a basketball game, they would play full court press, meaning every time they scored and the other team got the ball, they pressed the attack, and they were inside their opponent's court. So in basketball, right, like I mentioned before, you stand outside the court and you pass the ball in. Everybody familiar with that process, right? And usually everybody kind of pulls back and there are two people waiting for the ball to be passed in. But what happens when you have 5 people in your face? Your side of the court's uncovered. He said, statistically, more often, the girls on the team that was receiving the ball would run up the court to try and help the situation. That's when they would play man-on-man coverage. You have 5 seconds to pass that ball in there. And they didn't put a girl in front of the girl passing the ball in their face to wave their hand. They said, no, go ahead, give it a shot. I'll float and I'll knock it out of the other person's hand. Their stats on stealing and blocking went through the roof. Each girl that they faced became demoralized every time a ball got stolen away from them. The game suddenly took on greater pressure, larger anxiety. Like, suddenly I got to get the ball in there. I'm like, I only have 5 seconds. When you think of in football, right? You've got all these people racing at you. You're hoping your defense line holds up, and you're in a position where you have a much longer period of time to pass the ball. And the ball's easier to throw. In basketball, that is a weak point in your strategy. And what was interesting is, not only did they started to win games and went on a 15-0 streak, undefeated, to defeat them, the answer was simple. Press us. We're not good. We're hiding our own weakness by pressing the attack on you. And what would happen is these girls would win these games against coaches that are throwing chairs, that are yelling at their kids. And what happens when you yell at a 12-year-old? They shut down. So they're like, all we had to do was play the first half of the game. Like, after that, they undid themselves. As a matter of fact, the first game they lost, only 4 girls showed up to play from their team. So they said, why not? And the coach said, full court press, you're down 1 person. They only lost by 3 points. No one was expecting it. They actually went on to the national champion that same year that they implemented the strategy. It showed the spirit of someone going, let's rethink our approach. Is this resonating with anyone? You see, the beauty of being an underdog or being in a position where you don't have a lot of advantage, like I mentioned before, is you have to be innovative. You have to break away from the norm. You question, why is that the norm? Should we want success that way? What is the cost of being that big? As a church, we often kind of recognize, and one of the things that we love about our team here is they go, you know, we're unfettered by a lot of the weight that bigger churches have to carry. We don't have a large staff. We don't have a large building. You know, some people would look at that and go, man, you're at a disadvantage. I go, no, not at all. We don't ever have to worry about that stuff. I'm like, heck, I work a part-time job and intend to continue doing that. So we never have to worry about someone weighing down where we go and what we do. We're more mobile in that way. We've had to learn to adapt to our circumstances and our situation. Why? Because this isn't our building. These aren't our chairs, so we have to put them back at the end of the day. So remember. And we have to shut everything down, and we have to clean up after ourselves. Our volunteer rate goes up. Why? It takes more people to keep this train going. You can't just depend on a custodian to come up behind you and clean up after you because that's their job. That's not true. Suddenly, when we think of, like, how we're going to do things, we outsource a lot of our work. If we're going to do a big worship event, or like tomorrow night we're going to do this bigger dinner event, you know, suddenly we're going, man, we don't have that many worship leaders and people to help run this event. So we reach out and go, hey, anybody interested in being a part? And suddenly we get to partner with other churches. Where most of the time when you hit a level of success, you're focused on yourself. You see, what we fail to recognize sometimes is that both wealth and success carry the seeds of its own demise within itself. You look at someone who starts off without a lot of money. Let's use this as a perfect, me, no. Let's look at me, no. So you look at the situation of me and Alicia raising our daughters, and we say, we don't have it, we can't afford that right now, we can do something different. Our kids grow up hearing that, and as much as it might break some people's hearts, what do they learn at an early age? Sometimes you don't have something, and you do without it, and you figure it out. But what happens if you're raising kids and your name's Donald Trump? You see, it is true that money makes it easier for us to raise kids to some degree because we can help pay for sitters, we can help pay our bills, that kind of thing. But there comes a point where having too much money becomes a disadvantage. During an interview where I remember it was a wealthy celebrity. During an interview, he was asked, like, how do you raise your kids in your environment? And they were explaining, they're like, growing up, what got me to where I am today was the fact that I grew up poor. I had to work hard. I had to save. I had to think of ways to invest. I had to figure things out. I'm now raising kids who don't even think that way. How can I sit there and teach them about values when they've got a Ferrari that they got for free for their birthday? They don't know what that looks like. And I'm not saying in all cases, but in this particular interview that we're saying, you know, the majority of wealthy people find it even more difficult to raise kids because they have so much excess. And it's difficult to teach values for them. Because suddenly you go from, we can't, that's all I can tell you, kid, to we won't. And saying we won't is a lot harder. Because it means you have to live up to we won't. I remember visiting Haiti a few years ago and being moved by all these people who, despite their trials and their circumstances, they often found themselves still praising God and still worshiping him, even if they were hungry. And I remember sitting there and being moved, and the previous pastor of our church, we were standing next to each other, and he had said, don't forget, little brother, that while they can't enter the feasting table, you have to have the strength to push away and say, today I'll fast. One takes greater discipline. Because we recognize that both in our success and in our wealth, we can easily become complacent. We forget what it's like to be challenged. We forget what it's like to think outside the box. We forget what it's like to be innovative. Am I making sense? I think at City of Refuge, we have an opportunity to recover faster. Because we constantly allow for people to try new ideas and do something different because we have to think outside the box. And the percentage of failures goes up, right? People make mistakes. But the percentage of grace and mercy being shown goes up as well. The percentage of how often we have to sit back down and go, all right, The start was good, right? Like, we started off really well. We didn't end so bad. We ended pretty poorly. What can we do? What do we have to figure out? How do we get there? Any questions so far? No? Moving on to the next one? All right. How many of you guys are a fan of painting? Painting? Yeah? A couple people? All right. Anybody a fan of French Impressionism? Mm-hmm. Mimes, yes. French mimes. That was awesome. Thank you, Allison. So Monet, actually, that's who I'm going to mention. All right, if anyone here majored in French or like took French classes, I did, and I flunked out my third semester, so you can guarantee that I'm going to butcher all of these names. So, 150 years ago, when Paris was at the center of the art world, a group of painters used to gather together at Café Courbois in the neighborhood of Batignon. I know that one right. Batignon, did I say that right? Am I good, everybody? All right, I'm just going to keep going. My French and Hebrew are not where I'd like them to be. Together, this group of remarkable painters would go on to invent modern art within the movement known as Impressionism. They painted one another and painted next to one another and supported one another emotionally and financially. And today, their paintings hang in every major art museum in the world. But in the 1860s, they were struggling. These four painters were Edouard Monet, Pierre Renoir, Camille Pissarro, I remember that one, and Alfred Sisley, whatever. We're good. So these four remarkable painters were living in a time where to paint in Paris was a very competitive field, right? And as I'm about to read to you guys, like, they faced a lot of odds. And most of them were broke painters that, not broke as in the actual style of painting, but broke as in, like, they were broke. No money. You like that? Art history joke. And so, that was so stupid. I'm sorry. All right, moving on. Art played an enormous role in the culture of life of France in the 19th century. Painting was regulated by a government department called the Ministry of the Imperial House and the Fine Arts. It was considered a profession in the same way that medicine or law is a profession today. So imagine that.
Imagine that. Is that close enough? Okay.
A promising painter would start at the École Nationale something something in Paris, where he would receive a rigorous and formal education, processing from the copying drawings to the painting of live models. At each stage of his education, there would be competitions. Those who did poorly would be weeded out. Those who did well would win awards and prestigious fellowships. And at the art of this pinnacle profession was the Salon, the most important art exhibition in all of Europe, my friends. Every year, each of the painters of France submitted two or three of his finest canvases to a jury of experts. The deadline was the 1st of April. April Fools. Artists from around the world. That would have been me. Just kidding. Your painting sucks. Like, on to the next one. just got to give a little hope, right? They tried. Artists from around the world pushed hand carts loaded with canvases through Paris's cobblestone streets, bringing their work to the Palais de something, an exhibition hall built for the Paris World Fair. Maybe next time when I write my notes, I'll just translate them to English words, because this is America. Nope, I'm not going to have Google say things here. I'm speaking, not Google. It was an exhibition hall for the Paris World Fair between the Champs-Élysées and the Seine. All right, whatever. Boom. Done. I was waiting. I was seriously waiting. I'm like, what? Sue's just like, mm-hmm. So let's go to the church. The insolence is up here. I'm not innovative enough to sit there and listen to this giant butcher the French language. Throughout the next few weeks, a jury would vote on each painting in turn. Those deemed unacceptable would be stamped with a red letter R for rejected. It must have been a fun job. Those accepted would be hung on the walls of the palisade, and over the course of 6 weeks, beginning in early May, as many as a million people would throng the exhibition, jostling for position in front of the biggest and best-known artists' works and jeering at the works that did not that they did not like. The best paintings were given medals. The winners were celebrated and saw the value of their paintings soar. The losers limped home and went back to work. Wah, wah, wah. When the artist Jewel Hazepiffle didn't make it into the salon in 1866, he shot himself in the head. He was quoted for saying, "The members of the jury have rejected me, therefore I have no talent." Read his suicide note, "I must die." For a painter in the 19th century France, the salon was everything. And the reason that the salon was such an issue for the group of Impressionists was that time and time again, the salon jury turned them down. The salon's attitude was traditional. Works were expected to be microscopically accurate, properly finished, and formally framed, with proper perspective and all familiar artistic conventions. The art historian Sue Rowe writes, "Light denoted through high drama, darkness suggested gravitas. In a narrative painting, the scene should not only be accurate, but it should also set a morally acceptable tone. An afternoon at the salon was like a night at the Paris Opera. The audiences expected to be uplifted and entertained. For the most part, they knew that what they liked and expected to see what they knew, what kinds of paintings should win medals." Rose says, each of them fought hard. I'm sorry, let me read. Rose says were huge, meticulously painted canvases showing from French history or mythology, with horses and armies of beautiful women, with titles like "A Soldier's Departure," "A Young Woman Weeping Over a Letter," and "Abandoned Innocence." You see, the salon had a very narrow-minded approach to what good painting was. To a group of Impressionists, that was dumb. The Impressionists had an entirely different idea about what constituted art. They painted everyday life. Their brushstrokes were visible. Their figures were indistinct. To the salon jury, the salon jury and the crowds thronging the palisade, their work looked amateur, even shocking. In 1865, the salon surprisingly accepted a painting by Monet of a prostitute called Olympia, and the painting sent all of Paris into an uproar. Guards had to be placed around the painting to keep the crowds of spectators at bay. An atmosphere of hysteria and even fear permeated. The historian Ross King writes, "Some spectators were collapsed in epidemics of crazed laughter, while others, mainly women, turned their heads from the picture in fright." In 1868, Renoir, Bazille, Monet managed to get the paintings accepted by the salon. They finally were able to submit something that someone was willing to accept. But you know what was interesting about these guys? That they sat together and they said, "Why are we competing for their approval? Does it really matter if they get it and if they don't?" I mean, literally, one of them had finally been successful and got one accepted. But as they sat back at the same coffee house that they would meet weekly, they began to wonder if this is what they really wanted. Was it worth it, was a question they asked. Night after night, the Impressionists argued over whether they should keep knocking on the salon door, strike out on their own, and stage a show just for themselves. Did they want to be a little fish in a big pond of the salon, or a big fish in a little pond of their own choosing? In the end, the Impressionists made the right choice, which is one of the reasons that their paintings still hang in every major art museum in the world. But the same dilemma comes up time and time again in our own lives, and we often don't choose wisely. Our approach, most often than not, is we would rather be a little fish in a big pond than strike out on our own. We would rather fight the battle as everybody else does than to rethink our own lives and go, is this what we really want? There's a term that comes to mind when thinking about this. It's called relative deprivation. Laura and I agreed fiercely. We didn't argue. We agreed fiercely over this topic, just kind of looking at what this looks like for our church and really what it looks like in our own lives. You see, relative deprivation has to do with comparing yourself within the climate that you immediately find yourself in, right? So relative deprivation would be like City of Refuge comparing itself to local churches, right? It would be easy to look at Calvary Chapel and go, maybe we're not doing this right. Right? Or Coastline Community, who's a much bigger church. I'm not commenting on whether they're doing, you know, they are doing it right or wrong. Simply saying that to look at our local climate, it would be easy to be feel like we're at a disadvantage. But the problem with relative deprivation is that very rarely do we expand our borders of what we see as being in the entire climate that we're a part of, or let's say Christendom exists in. So in the examples of Monet and these guys, in Paris, they were having to compete for attention. But if they take a step back and look globally, they were considered among the elites that were painting. And suddenly you begin to realize, like, what we're a part of, both in Salt Lake City, what we're a part of in some of the local outreaches that we do with local churches, what we're a part of in Alaska, LA, and all the different areas that we connect with, is part of a global shift and change that looks a lot more like it's doing well than maybe some of the localized groups that we see. Because we begin to see the shifts in climate start at the bottom and slowly raise to the top. And we find ourselves catching that wave along with many others, even if in our immediate vicinity, it might not look that way. Does that make sense? There's this guy that Neil competed in a recent strength, strongman challenge. And this guy's from Miami. And he recently put up an awesome video where he was just like, clearly he had just got done working out and was still like, testosterone raging, like, because he's like yelling at the camera that he's sort of looking at, and he was saying that he sees all these people that come to his gym, and he owns his gym in Miami, and he sees all these people that compete in strongman, and so many of these guys get so discouraged that they're not hitting the results that they're looking for. And he goes that sometimes he's got to sit with these guys and encourage them and go, you got to understand something. You're walking in here and you're competing. Just by simply doing that, you're among the 9% of people in the world that are capable of doing what you just did. But if you're going to look at all the bigger guys around you right here, you're going to feel like you can't make it. But if you have the perspective of realizing, no, we're part of something much bigger, things change, and they change rapidly. I wanted to read one more story to you guys. It's like close to 8 o'clock, so we'll tone it down. I will summarize. There was recently a study that compared the stats of two colleges, Hartwick University and Harvard, and they were comparing the stats of these two. Of these two schools, because they were trying to illustrate a point of whether it's better to go to an Ivy League school or to go to a regular school, right? I think in our current, you know, climate, what we tend to think is if you go to an Ivy League school, you are going to excel and do well and become this prestigious person versus if you go to a regular college. And they were noticing the dropout rates in certain colleges and how competitive some of those elite colleges were and what that was doing to the morale of many of the students that were there. And so they did the study and they said they were looking at the enrollment for STEM courses, STEM majors, science, technology, engineering, and math, I think is what M stands for. And they were looking at how many kids started off trying to get a STEM degree and how many of them decided to just switch to a liberal arts degree when they took classes that they could not succeed in. And so they were trying to look, they began to compare the SAT scores between these two colleges and trying to illustrate this very same point. It says, to get a sense of who is dropping out and why, let's take a look at the science enrollment of a school in upstate New York called Hartwick College. It's a small liberal arts college that's sort of that is common in the American Northeast. Here, all the Hartwick STEM majors are divided into three groups. The top, middle, and the top third, middle third, and bottom third. According to the test scores in mathematics, the scores are from the SAT, the exam used by many American colleges as an admission test. The mathematics section of the test is out of 800 points. So the numbers I'm going to read is out of 800 points. So among the elites of Hartwick College, who wanted to be STEM majors, their math scores were as follows. Top third, 569 points out of 800. Middle third, 472 points out of 800. Bottom third, 407 points. All right? So they relatively stay within the high 500s to the low 400s. So if you got your guys that are the top of your class are getting 569, and your guys at the bottom that are switching majors at 407. If we were to take the SAT as a guide, there's a pretty big difference in raw math ability between the best and the poor students of Hartwick. Now let's look at the portion of all science degrees at Hartwick that are earned by each of these groups. The top third, 55% of them, gain a degree in STEM. The middle third, only 27.1% end up getting a degree. And the bottom third, only 17.8% get a degree in STEM. So are we seeing that? Obviously, the lower your SAT scores, the less you're likely to major in one of the STEM majors. So let's look at Harvard's number, just to compare it. Top third, 753 points. And their SATs out of 800. Middle third, 674 points. Bottom third, 581 points. Meaning the lowest person at Harvard is kicking the crap out of the student in Hartwick, right? So let's look at the ones who actually succeeded in getting a major in STEM. Top third, 53%, same as Hartwick. Middle third, 31%, same as Hartwick. Bottom third, 15%, same as Hartwick. The smartest math person could not get a degree in his major in Harvard, even though his SAT score, the bottom third, was greater than that of the kids at Hartwick. Why is that? So they're going, these kids have the raw intelligence to gain this degree. They have the raw ability to make it there. Why can't they? And they discovered when interviewing the students that were considered at the bottom third is that the very same thing that made Harvard successful in producing these like Ivy League students was the very thing that knocked everybody else down. They made it competitive. And if you couldn't keep up, you fell in droves. And so most of these kids that were in the bottom third would have done better to have gone into a smaller pond and have been a bigger fish and have succeeded in their degree. Because statistically, they would have gotten it. Then the majority of students that ended up switching majors because they felt demoralized and like they couldn't hack it. And spend the rest of their lives regretting switching their majors. Why? Because we want to play by the rules that the world works. We say we want to compete on that level. We say we want to fight the way they fight, blow for blow, when in reality, most of the times, we would have done better to reconsider our skill set and have a different approach. If the idea is to work in the field of your dreams, I'm not saying that we walk away from challenges. Not saying you take the easier path. But are things as cracked up as other people say they are? When I meet with pastors of bigger churches and I hear them rattle off like the issues that they have, I'm like, no, thank you. Like, I don't even want to hear about it. Like, it gives me anxiety to hear you describe what you just described. We don't have those issues. We don't want those issues. We're figuring something else out. You know, when I get to share about the different things that people in this church are involved, because in our church, we recognize that we want to keep families and community as higher up on our value system. So we don't want to take away people from their homes by putting them in another outreach thing, in another program that we're doing that week. Instead, we prefer to help people do whatever God's called them to do and do evangelism within their own context, what you're passionate about, where your heart's at. Whereas every time I hear another church say that they're going to do another outreach group and the amount of manpower that they have to generate so that they can make this thing successful, and then you see the anxiety on all these parents' faces as they're trying to volunteer, make this happen in the hours that they're spending away from their wife and their kids, you start going, is that even worth it? Is that what it's supposed to look like? shoot me in the head because I do not want to be involved. Like, at the end of the day, it's the reality that is that what we really want? Is that what we're looking for? While relative deprivation isn't necessarily a strength, I certainly think it's a perspective that we try to maintain as a community. It's the realization that it's easy to compare ourselves to the local enterprise and feel like you're less than it is to recognize the global community you're part of. But secondly, it also gives us a thermometer to measure some of our success rates here in our group. You see, I'll talk about one of our weaknesses. We do a great job on relationships. If, like Harvard, you scored on the top third of within our group. But we can come off as very cliquish for newcomers who try to come in and be a part of it. Suddenly, unless you have the social skills or the draw or whatever it is to be able to, you know, fit in and connect, you might feel like, man, I'm at the bottom third. Why am I even here? And so we have to sit back and go, man, we don't want to be that either. We want to make community easy if it's a part of our value system. We want to make relationship accessible if it's a part of our value system. That's what's going to maintain our perspective versus something that can seem unsustainable. Am I making sense? Is this weird? Am I like, is anyone like, why is he telling your stories close? Please just shut up and finish it. We did it. All right, last verse of the night, and then we'll begin to close. Begin to close. All right, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 8 through 10. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast in all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in my weakness, in insults, in hardships, in persecution, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 8 through 10. Paul is acknowledging that there's something about our weakness that causes us to rethink our approach, to lean on God. And he later on illustrates that it's at the moment of weak that you discover your weakness, that you can find yourself strong, find yourself overcoming, find yourself navigating around your obstacle. I would love, and because it's 8 o'clock, I won't, to go into some of the stats and challenges that people with dyslexia have. My wife, who struggled with dyslexia growing up, and it's a common problem that many kids grow up having, right? But did you know that statistically, among innovators, inventors, and entrepreneurs, is a larger amount of they have a higher stat of dyslexic people that actually enter those fields than any other fields anywhere in the world. Because most people who struggle with dyslexia spend their entire lives having to navigate around reading and writing. They spend their entire life struggling, so they have to rethink their approach on everything. One of my favorite examples is this guy named David Boies. He's a litigator. He's a famous litigator in the U.S. Maybe not famous within our crowd, but we're like, you, maybe? I don't know. Okay. Wendy's in law. I'm like, none of us are in law. Oh, yeah. You feel me. David Boies was born with dyslexia and struggled with reading. He was 9 years old by the time he was diagnosed with it. That means he had spent the majority of the years that most kids would have spent reading and writing, about five or six years on the really smart kids, on that end, learning to listen well. He had to rethink the way he took exams. He had to rethink the way his approach to reading and writing, because his entire life he was at a severe disadvantage. But this is where his weakness became his strength. He decides he wants to go to law school. Okay. And he's like, not corporate law, where you have to do all the reading and look at all the little nuances and how words connect and what that means in this contract. But he wants to be a litigator. He wants to argue, because he's developed and sharpened his communication skills. So he goes to law school. And while other kids were sitting there writing all their notes, he listened and listened and listened and discovered that he was really good at memorizing what other people said. He was really good at watching people and seeing how their breathing patterns changed. And he slowly started becoming a human lie detector. So he had this this case in which he was a part of, and he said, you know, a common thing among people who struggle with dyslexia is that they take very complicated things and they simplify them. They have to, because they have to make it edible, that their minds can really understand and chew on things. And so he spent his entire career listening well and being able to tell when someone was lying or being able to tell when someone wasn't saying something the way they said it. As a matter of fact, he would walk into the courtroom and he would begin to repeat verbatim what was said when a person was cross-examined. And most people found themselves tripping on those words. I will close. I apologize. Chris is like, face warning of anger. Gary Cohan worked in the Stock Exchange in the World Trade Center before the World Trade Center went down. And he was another guy that grew up dyslexic his entire life. And so he had to learn to fake being smart. I love it. He's like, I didn't know what anybody else was talking about. I didn't know what they're saying, so I learned to lie. I learned to find a way to adapt to my situation. He lied his way into getting a job at one of the companies in downtown New York. He read up as much as he could and had people read him the books on how to successfully buy and sell stock. And at his interview, he killed it. And he said, I learned to read the numbers. I learned to read the patterns. And eventually, he's like, I never told my boss that I actually never had a degree in any of that stuff, that I had lied, you know, bullcrap my whole way through it. But he goes, but at the end of the day, I don't think he ever cared because I was successful and I made him a lot of money. I was adaptable. The unique thing I think about our church and our community is that we're an adaptable group of people. We're having to constantly look at our own weaknesses and go, God, we want you to be strengthened and perfect our weaknesses. And we begin to utilize it as the platform to our transformation and our change. And it then allows us, like David, to go, I may not be the biggest dude here. I may not be the strongest guy, but that doesn't mean we can't win. It doesn't mean that we don't have the competitive edge. It doesn't mean that we can't somehow navigate and figure out how we can make it to the top. I think the beauty of who we are, and my hope, the DNA that I hope you guys carry, is to be innovative, to rethink your circumstances and situation, to not see it so linear and see it so simple, to ask the question, where does power lie in this situation and circumstance? Is it as simple as they say? Should I play the field that they're playing? It's to take the opportunity and be adaptable and say, maybe this didn't work, but we can try something different. You see, the one thing I'm grateful for is that I sucked at most things I ever did my entire life. Failure in coping with it is not a big deal for me. And that's not to say that I don't react negatively to failure in the sense of like I don't get angry, but it's to say that I rarely ever see failure as like a permanent setback. To me, it's like, okay, I know that that doesn't work now. Let's try something different. I know people who have been good at everything their entire lives and they cannot cope with failure. To mess up means that they can't recover from it, that they don't have what it takes, that they're not good enough. Then those who can accept their weaknesses and go, I'm not good at that, but I can figure my way around it. Can we be adaptable? Can we choose to be innovative? Can we choose to maintain perspective and recognize what God's doing on a larger scale and make the enemy fight on our home turf? Was that all right? You guys want to stand up and we can pray out? I kept you 10 minutes late. Be adaptable and find a way to get to that restaurant in the next few minutes, wherever we're eating next. Where are we eating tonight? Okay, never mind. Scatter. We are undone. Heavenly Father, we just thank you, Lord, that you have modeled what weakness looks like when you perfect it. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have repeatedly in your word shown us how what you think of underdogs and how you choose to transform culture, community, economics, government, military, Lord, that you draw those who are less than and make them more than, that you make them the standard of tomorrow. May our eyes be set in faith what you're doing next, and may, Lord, we always walk in circumspect wisdom in all of our approaches. We ask, Father God, that you would be glorified in what we lay our hands to, that we would see you, Lord, move in ways that we have never seen before, because we dared to believe and dared to think differently. In Jesus' name, amen.